It made headlines in the press, who wondered, what could have caused this collective hallucination? Impôts Saint-Esprit, the locals panic, and nobody will touch the bread. The hearses quickly arrive in the village. In total, 7 deaths, 300 people poisoned, and around 50 admitted to psychiatric wards. The first dead were buried. The investigators initially thought it was a return of St. Anthony's fire, a disease that killed many thousands in the Middle Ages, caused by a parasitic ergo fungus that attacks cereals. The baker was accused of poisoning, then the miller. Arrested and incarcerated, they were released after several months. They say that their confessions were made under duress, and above all, the evidence proved their innocence. It was then thought to be water poisoning, mercury, fertilizers, or a nearby gas factory. But the evidence disapproved these theories one by one. Since then, in Pont Saint-Esprit, more far-fetched theories have surfaced. Nothing is clear, and for decades the incident goes unexplained. But against all expectations, 60 years later, a new theory is proposed. Not from France, but from the United States. An American researcher in the Secret Services, Hank Alberelli, is investigating the suspicious death of a biochemist from the CIA, Frank Olson. A specialist in chemical weapons, he carried out experiments on hard drugs like LSD. He was also in France a few months before the Pont Saint-Esprit incident. Afterwards, he kept sinking into depression, telling his wife that he'd made a terrible mistake. Hank Alberelli then made the link with the Pont Saint-Esprit incident. Could it have been the CIA and the American Army spraying LSD onto the bread?
I have no doubt at all that Pont Saint-Esprit was a U.S. Army covert experiment. Initially, I had doubts, and I think initially my doubts were motivated by wishful thinking on my part, where I didn't want it to be an experiment. It was hard to fathom the government doing that. Although at the same time, there were a number of research tracks that were being conducted for the book at the same time. So my being naive about what the government and the U.S. Army was capable of doing was the threshold for that was dwindling.
Is it possible that the Americans drugged an entire village in an ally country, causing, no doubt accidentally, the death of 7 people? Improbable. However, to understand what happened in Pont Saint-Esprit, we need to look back at the end of the Second World War, when the level of atrocities committed by the Nazis was discovered in the camps. Notably, horrific experiments carried out on thousands of prisoners by chemists or doctors. Men lacerated, poisoned, burnt alive, exposed to radiation. The Allies hunted the war criminals from Hitler's regime. In 1946, in Nuremberg, the doctors are put on trial. 22 men and one woman who experimented on human beings, who they transformed into lab rats, stand accused. The trial sets a precedent. 7 of the accused are sentenced to death, 11 given prison sentences, and 5 are acquitted. As a result, the Americans draft the Nuremberg Code, a model which gives strict rules for experimenting on humans, notably the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. The experiment must be designed to avoid all unnecessary suffering, physical and mental harm. With the Nuremberg trial barely over, the winners remain cynical. The American Secret Service begins Operation Paperclip. Nearly 1,500 German scientists, including war criminals, are expatriated to America. They are offered a new life in exchange for their knowledge and cooperation.
It was a very serious game of propaganda that we were playing. It was almost a show trial. We're putting the Nazis on trial, but in fact, behind the curtain, we're doing some very nasty things ourselves to basically incarcerated people, poor people, individuals who at the time were called feeble-minded and locked up in institutions. And if you were in one of those institutions, whether you were indigent or an unwed mother or had some sort of mental incapacity, there's a good chance that you may have been incorporated in some sort of medical study, possibly for the government or not, where you would have been used and abused.
Assisted by the German scientists, the Americans begin pursuing their goal of the ultimate weapon, and everything is allowed in the name of the Cold War. On the one side was the Army, whose priority is to win the nuclear arms race. At the time, to test the effects of radiation on a large scale, they used their own soldiers, who were docile and disciplined. Between 1946 and 1962, between 250,000 and 500,000 men were exposed to radiation on Bikini Atoll or in the Nevada desert. They were exposed with no protection, unaware of the risks involved. And afterwards, the radiated particles were cleaned up with brooms.
How about radiation? Do you think there's much danger from radiation?
Well, radiation is the least of the worries that they're thinking about.
I think most people thought that radiation was the greatest danger, didn't they? Where did they learn different?
Well, prior to our instructions here, we received a very thorough briefing before we even came in this close to contact with it.
On the other side was the CIA, who was above all interested in psychological manipulation. Their goal was to create an infallible truth serum, wipe memories, turn humans into robots, and program them to kill. Conveniently, in 1948, a researcher in the Sandoz laboratories, Albert Hoffman, discovers a molecule that ignites the Secret Service, lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. It's derived from the same rye fungus, long held responsible for the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. It was believed that the hallucinogenic properties of this drug were key to psychological manipulation. Fearing that the Russians would get their hands on Sandoz's samples, the Americans bought all of their stock. The discovery of LSD was a godsend for the Army, who on the brink of nuclear weapons were looking for a weapon that could defeat an enemy without firing any weapons. The man who was head of this program longest was James Ketchum, shown here in uniform. He was a psychiatrist who was working for the military. As a patriot, he was prepared to push the boundaries in his research. He tested around 30 drugs, but especially LSD and the dangerous benzylate. He treated 7,000 soldiers, hundreds of whom later sued the Army because of the side effects that they still experience and attribute to these drugs. However, when questioned, James Ketchum sees things differently.
I think they were very patriotic. They've not been given credit. They've been called innocent guinea pigs, which they certainly were not. They knew what they were doing, and we told them as much as we could about it. We had to limit the names of the drugs because some of them were artificially made, and if we were to give out the name, of course, that would also reveal the structure, and that we were afraid the Russians would get that. They were apparently following our work. We thought they were ahead of us, but actually they weren't, and so they were watching what we did to see what they could learn and use, and they developed a similar drug later themselves.
In parallel with the Army, the CIA was also developing its own programs, codenamed Bluebird, Artichoke, and later MKUltra. But to carry out these programs on a large scale, they needed funds. In 1950, the Korean War gave them the ideal pretext. Some American soldiers were captured. During their detention, pilots admitted having dropped chemical weapons onto Korea, which was forbidden. The Americans claimed this was due to psychological manipulation, and the CIA took advantage of this godsend to obtain budgets that allowed them to work on brainwashing.
During the Korean War, the American pilots who were captured started making apparently false confessions of germ warfare. So the first question is, was it really false confessions? But then when they were brought back to the United States, the military and the military psychiatrists studied them and decided that there's mind control operations being run against Americans. So for defensive purposes, we had to study this, figure it out, therefore we created MKUltra. Before MKUltra was Bluebird and Artichoke. So the whole rationale is it's defensive. It's because of what the communists are doing. Problem is, the Korean War started in June 1950, and Bluebird was signed into operation by the head of the CIA in April 1950.
In the Edgewood camp where James Ketchum worked, soldiers are called upon more and more. They think they're testing gas masks. In reality, the canisters are filled with a toxic chemical.
They were testing a whole assortment of different hallucinogens like LSD and marijuana and things like that. And they explored other drugs, very high levels of atropine, scopolamine, benzolates, very powerful. And a lot of these soldiers ended up incapacitated. It took them a long time to recover. And while they're in recovery, the doctors cannot do any more experiments because it's basically a very small base and testing operation. In other words, they needed a new site.
It's in this context of the Cold War and secret agents that on the 16th of August, 1951, the tragedy at Pont Saint-Esprit unfolded. France was suffering economically, and the Americans distrusted this ally they couldn't control. The village was under the control of socialists at the time. In the eyes of America, they were Reds, the epitome of the Soviet danger. But the mayor, Roger Castillon, doesn't believe in a foreign conspiracy. Yet American experts like Colin Ross are much more down to earth.
Obviously, that compound didn't just come in the rain, or just wasn't sitting around naturally. It was obviously organized, controlled, distributed. So whether it was actually LSD or some other compound, well, doesn't make that much difference. Pont Saint-Esprit is actually not just this happened once in the world in a village in France. It's consistent with all the other experiments on the public that have done in the United States and done for a documented fact.
To achieve their goals, would the Americans be prepared to use a whole village as a laboratory? After all, these are civilians, not trained soldiers. However, in September 1950, nearly 1 year before Pont Saint-Esprit, this is exactly what they did, and in their own country. off the coast of San Francisco, the American Marines were carrying out military maneuvers. A ship approached the coast and bombarded the city with a bacteria causing nucosomia, Serratia marcescens. The military were testing the effects of spraying this through the air. This classified secret defense map shows the scale of the targeted area. At least 11 people were hospitalized, one of whom died of pneumonia. The villagers wonder why a supposedly festive drug that is loved by hippies would have had such terrifying effects at Pont Saint-Esprit. James Ketchum, the military psychiatrist who specialized in LSD, a little reluctantly, admits that the drug is scary for those who take it unknowingly.
Some individuals could have a bad trip if someone gave them LSD and didn't tell them about it. That's very anxiety-producing. Or if they were inexperienced and not particularly well-balanced themselves, took a fairly large dose of LSD, they could have a bad trip. How would you feel if you had a cup of coffee and started to see things going like this or like this, or brilliant colors appear on the ceiling, or suddenly you felt you're out of your body and looking down on yourself? These are all things that can happen with LSD.
But can these effects have a delayed onset? In Pont Saint-Esprit, the older generation remember the night of the apocalypse, where dozens of men went mad and were sectioned in a psychiatric unit because of terrifying visions. This night took place more than 2 weeks after the cursed bread was consumed. But again, James Ketchum admits that it's possible.
Some individuals had flashbacks later in which they would go into a situation where they had been when they were taking LSD and have a flood of the same emotions and some of them anxiety producing.
In 1951, French investigators also consider LSD and call upon Albert Hoffman, inventor of the drug. On the spot, he tells the investigators that he has no doubt that the hallucinations were due to LSD. But after returning to Switzerland, he backtracks, claiming he was mistaken. The French want explanations, but public health documents from 1951 show that the expert became suddenly unreachable. We are sorry that the eminent professor has not been able to get back in touch with us.
I would think if the Sandoz scientists are saying it doesn't seem to be LSD, they're just trying to cover up the fact that it's 100% for sure that LSD must have come from Sandoz, because they were the only suppliers. It's nothing more than a cover-up.
After months of inquiry, the French investigators were so disoriented by the number of fruitless leads that the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit falls victim to its own mystery. During this time, the experiments continued in the United States, and they reached a level never seen before in any country, including the Soviet bloc.
The Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
Allahumma inni ataqarrabu ilayka bidhikrak wa astashfi'u bika ila nafsak وأسألك بجودك أن تدنيني من قربك وأن توزعني شكرك وأن تلهمني ذكرك. اللهم إني أسألك سؤال خاضع متذلل خاشع أن تسامحني وترحمني وتجعلني بقسمك راضيا قانعا.
Dear listeners, as you have been previously with us, the part under discussion was this divine phrase of the Kumail supplication, where the commander of the believers, Imam Ali alayhi salam, says, Allahumma inni as'aluka su'ala khadi'in mutadhallilin khashi'. O Allah, verily, I ask you with the asking of a submissive, abased, and lowly man, and to samihani, to show me forbearance, wa tarhamani, and to have mercy on me, وَتَجْعَلَنِي بِقِسْمِكَ رَاضِيًا قَانِعًا, and to make me satisfied and content with your apportionment, وَفِي جَمِيعِ الْأَحْوَالِ مُتَوَادِعًا, and make me humble in every state. Imam Ali alayhi salam, in this part of the Kumail supplication, is humbly asking the Almighty Allah for requests, and he is hoping that he is about to reach the compliance of the Almighty Allah with his submission and humbleness. The four requests are Allah's forbearance towards him, the second is his mercy, the third is satisfaction, and the fourth is humbleness. Now, we were talking about the satisfaction request. We concluded that all the creatures that have been created have been provided with sustenance in accordance with their lifestyle and activities for acquiring sustenance. And we said how important it is for us to try to have endeavor for reaching sustenance.
Oh Allah, I seek to draw myself nearer to you through your invocation, and I pray to you to intercede on my behalf, and I beg you by your benevolence to draw me nearer to you and grant thankfulness towards you and inspire me to remember and to invoke you. Oh Allah, I ask you, begging submissively, humbly, and awe-strickenly, to treat me with clemency and mercy, and to make me pleased and content with what you have granted me, and cause me to be modest and unassuming in all circumstances. Oh Allah, I beg as one whose neediness is extreme, and who supplicates his knees to you, and whose desire for that which is with you has become great. Oh Allah, great is your kingdom, and exalted is your greatness. Your plan is secret, your authority is manifest, your might is victorious and subduing, and your power is prevalent throughout, and it is not possible to escape from your dominion. O Allah, apart from you, I do not find anyone able to pardon my sins, nor to conceal my shameful acts, nor do I have anyone except you to change my evil deeds into virtues.
One point needs to be mentioned, dear listeners, in this regard. Human sustenance is a reality that is provided on earth, and everyone has been set with a definite amount. As we touched upon this issue earlier, this definite amount is either extended or narrowed according to Almighty Allah's expedience. The extendedness of someone's sustenance does not imply that he is close to the Almighty Allah. It doesn't prove that he is a true servant. It does not imply his amiability before Almighty Allah. And nor does one's narrow sustenance mean that he is disfavored. Rather, the extension or the narrowing of the sustenance is Almighty Allah's test of gratitude for the rich and of patience for the poor. So the grateful and the patient servants would be rewarded in this way. The rich would also be rewarded by granting the poor, and the poor by maintaining faith and by being patient for the certain fate. Imam Hassan Mujtaba alayhi salam says in this regard, كَيْفَ يَكُونُ الْمُؤْمِنُ مُؤْمِنًا وَهُوَ يَسْخَطُ قِسْمَهُ وَيُحَقِّرُ مَنْزِلَتَهُ. How can a Muslim believer be discontent with his portion of sustenance? In fact, it could be said that in this part, Imam alayhi salam is referring to this part of the supplication Kumail. وَتَجْعَلَنِي بِقِسْمِكَ رَاضِيًا قَانِعًا. Make me satisfied and content with your apportionment. Anyway, Imam alayhi salam says, how can a Muslim believer be discontent with his portion of sustenance and considers his position low, while the one who dominates all his endeavors is Allah? وَالْحَاكِمُ عَلَيْهِ Allah. The Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam asked Gabriel, what is the exposition of content? He answered, الرَّاضِي لَا يَسْخَطُ عَلَى سَيِّدِهِ. The content servant does not take anger over his Lord. أَصَابَ مِنَ الدُّنْيَا أَمْ لَمْ يُصِبْ. Whether he possesses something in the world or not. وَلَا يَرْضَى لِنَفْسِهِ بِالْيَسِيرِ مِنَ الْعَمَلِ. And he is not content with his own trivial deeds. He's always in trying. He's always doing as much as he can, because this is the true meaning of servitude. And because he knows that this religion has told him, اِرْضَ بِمَا قَسَمَ اللَّهُ لَكْ تَكُنْ غَنِيًّا. If you are content with Almighty Allah's sustenance, you would get needless. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We'll continue to talk about this request and this part of the supplication more in the next program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
IRIB English Radio.
Russia dismisses new U.S. media reports about a possible Russian attack on Ukraine, accusing Washington of trying to aggravate the situation while blaming Moscow. Pope Francis criticizes Europe's lack of coordination on migration, saying the continent is torn by nationalist egoism. And the number of daily COVID deaths in Iran reaches its lowest in 9 months. Hello and welcome to World News. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Appreciate you joining us. Well, Moscow dismisses new U.S. media reports about a possible Russian attack on Ukraine. It instead accuses Washington of provocative actions near Russian borders. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman has been cited by a newspaper as saying that the U.S. is conducting a special operation to aggravate the situation around Ukraine. Maria Zakharova has accused Washington of adopting accusatory rhetoric to shift the responsibility for the escalation onto Russia. The remarks were made after a Saturday report by the Washington Post accusing Russia of planning a multi-front offensive on Ukraine early next year. Now, this is the second time in the past month that U.S. media has made such a claim. Moscow says the allegations could be aimed at diverting attention from Kiev's own plans to escalate tensions in eastern Ukraine. Political commentator Tim Kirby believes U.S. media reports about Russia's possible attack on Ukraine are part of Washington's broader campaign to create further rift between Moscow and Kiev.
We can't forget that since the Maidan Revolution of 2014, the mainstream media has reported that Russia has already invaded Ukraine multiple times. Now they're writing that there is a threat of invasion. All right, so first off, this is already sort of in a 1984 nutty world. About the Russian reaction, Russians are very concerned right now that this is going to be what you could call the big one. When the mainstream media turns their eye to something, they always escalate or inflate, and it's never purely coincidental, I'll put it that way. There's a lot of events going on all over the world. Some are shown, some are not, and this one is definitely getting the hype as of today. I think that there is some sort of attempt to create a final rift between the Ukraine and Russia to sort of end this issue in a way that's going to be favorable to Washington. Because as Zbigniew Brzezinski said, Russia will never be, this is a paraphrase, Russia will never be a great empire or superpower again without the Ukraine. So perhaps that's what they're trying to do.
Well, the head of the Roman Catholic Church blames the EU's nationalist divisions for deepening migrant problems in Europe. Pope Francis says the European community avoids making decisions and at times is uncoordinated on the migrant issue. Francis called for unity among European countries in dealing with migrants. He made the criticism in a meeting with the EU and Greek officials while visiting Athens. Earlier in his trip, the pontiff condemned conditions in migrant camps in Cyprus. Greece is one of the main entry points into the EU for asylum seekers. Critics are warning of worsening condition for migrants and refugees across European borders. Well, the French president is in Saudi Arabia as part of a visit to a number of Persian Gulf Arab countries. Macron is the first Western leader to visit Riyadh since Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi was killed and dismembered inside of the kingdom's Istanbul consulate in 2018. More in the following report.
French President Emmanuel Macron met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman in the Saudi city of Jeddah and discussed a whole range of issues, including crisis in Lebanon, which has been suffering from economic hardships for the past several years. Macron's visit to Saudi Arabia is overshadowed by the 2018 assassination of Saudi critic and journalist Jamal Khashoggi. American intelligence agencies have concluded that the murder was directly ordered by Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS. The visit has drawn reactions from human rights groups. They accused the French president of trying to, quote, rehabilitate MBS. Critics argue that nothing can justify Macron's trip given Saudi Arabia's human rights violations.
Whatever strategic interest France has in Saudi Arabia, nothing can justify their legitimization of a ruler who kills journalists, threatens activists, imprisons women human rights defenders, slaughters Yemeni civilians, and deceives the international community. Macron diminishes himself and his country as he stoops to partnership with MBS.
Macron has rejected the accusations, claiming that the dialogue with Saudi Arabia was necessary to work for stability in the region. The visit is part of the two-day tour to the Persian Gulf that earlier took Macron to the UAE and Qatar. In the UAE, he signed a record $15.8 billion contract for selling 80 French Rafale warplanes. Rights bodies again came out vocal about the sale. They criticized the agreement, blaming the Emiratis for playing a prominent role in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. Signing a major weapons deal with a country involved in the war on Yemen raises speculations as to what exactly Paris is looking for in such trips. Such a sale is especially under the spotlight at a time when France has been deprived of a share in a lucrative security pact among Australia, the UK, and the US. That, along with the fact that France is one of the largest weapons exported to Saudi Arabia, brings one to the conclusion that France is only after selling its military hardware, despite the war crimes Riyadh has committed and the irreparable loss of hundreds of thousands of civilian lives during the ongoing war on Yemen.
The dispute over general elections in Iraq is dragging on. The head of Iraq's Fatah alliance, Hadi Amiri, has once again rejected the results. Amiri accuses the country's election commission of mismanagement and violations. He says the commission did not present any report on voting irregularities to parliament. Amiri promised not to back down from the lawsuit on election fraud and to continue the process in federal court. He also accused the UN envoy of Iraq to Iraq of interfering in the election process. On Tuesday, the Electoral Commission reconfirmed the political bloc led by Mokhtar al-Saad as the winner of October's parliamentary elections. Following weeks of recounting, the federal court now needs to approve the final results. The Fatah Alliance and several political groups oppose the vote outcome. Israeli forces shoot dead a Palestinian in occupied Al-Quds after an alleged stabbing attack. The incident took place near the Damascus Gate, just outside of the Old City. The Palestinian was identified as a 25-year-old man from the occupied West Bank. Israeli police said he tried to stab an officer after wounding a first man. Footage from the scene showed Israeli forces shooting at the man at least twice after he was already lying on the ground. Another video appears to show police with guns drawn, preventing medics from reaching the man. Clashes later broke out on the scene between Palestinians and Israeli forces who used stun grenades. Israel has repeatedly been criticized for extensive use of lethal force against Palestinians and their extrajudicial killings. Moving on to other news now this hour. Iran's chief negotiator to the Vienna talks says the two proposed drafts Tehran has presented to other parties cannot be rejected. Ali Bakri Khani told Al Jazeera TV that the draft documents are based on the provisions of the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement. He added that Iran will submit a third proposal once the first two are accepted. He insisted that U.S. sanctions against Iran must be lifted immediately. Iran proposed its documents during the latest round of talks that ended on Friday in Vienna. Tehran has already made it clear that the negotiations should be result-oriented. It says the talks should lead to the removal of the sanctions that the U.S. imposed after it withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018. Well, with the new round of negotiations between Iran and signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, it has ended now in Vienna. Europeans are calling for more time to prepare a response to Iran's proposals. Now, hashtag trending is next with a review of the social media's response to this story.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another hashtag trending with me, Ali Reza. The new round of negotiations between Iran and the nuclear accord parties was held in Vienna, with the Iranian team back to the negotiation table with a firm stance to break the impasse and reach an agreement. Time to review some social media reactions to this story. The Iranian negotiators in Vienna were accompanied by a team of economic and financial experts while the Europeans seem to lack initiative in the face of Iran's proposal that were made under the framework of the JCPOA. So they called for a pause to be able to return home for more consultations. Meanwhile, social media has been filled with comments about Israel trying to sabotage the negotiations by pressuring the U.S. into blaming Iran for any possible collapse of the talks. And it seems that the blame game is already out of the bag. Our first comment on Twitter by Said Khatibzadeh reads, "As Vienna talks advances, Israeli regime shows its true color again, calling for the immediate halt of negotiations. Not surprising, dialogue is always despised by the regime whose genesis is based on war, tension, and terror. Delegates in Vienna won't take instruction from Beit Aryun." That was a tweet by the spokesperson of Iran's foreign ministry. David Moses wrote, "USA cannot remove sanctions until authorization from Tel Aviv, the master of the great elephant." Ariane also wrote, "It is a diplomatic war and not a diplomatic meeting. U.S. real is attacking Iranian national sovereignty for decades, and now with the same cabal seating at the same table and calling it negotiation is mind and brainwashing. Iranians have suffered under sanctions and never bowed down. Cabals are now trying to break Iranians' will by the means of dialogue and table bombing. All options on the table, criminals." On Twitter, Mustafa wrote, "I wished the Iranian negotiators had also asked for compensatory and punitive damages in addition to the removal of the sanctions, which in reality was coercion with a criminal objective." Well, that's why Iran's negotiating team wants guarantees that the deal will remain in place. Now, many believe that the U.S. can't get anything from Iran and Vienna unless it changes its approach towards the country and engages in real talk. They also believe that Iran should be provided with compensatory damages, as it was the U.S. which pulled from the deal and imposed sanctions on Iran. Our next comment comes from S.M. Khoshchesh. He wrote, "Unless U.S.-led West in Vienna talks changes approach to give a serious view to Iranian drafts, it may not earn anything. Lack of heed and blame game would bring them no fruits. No one buys the abort plan. Time to change theatrical talks strategy to real action. Of course, not Act 2. Farid wrote, "Time for this circus is up. Iran should give the Americans and Europeans 2 weeks to decide if they agree to remove all sanctions to revive JCPOA. Otherwise, it should announce Iran will leave not only JCPOA, but NPT and every other so-called one-sided international agreement, if there is no tangible benefit for Iran." Manoucher also wrote, "Iran must ask them to give a guarantee that they will stay loyal and committed to the deal. Otherwise, there is no point in negotiating with them." Wise Somali wrote, "Paying the full compensatory damages is the only viable guarantee from the U.S. not to withdraw again. Iran should not agree to the U.S. return to the agreement without paying the cost incurred in their first withdrawal from the agreement. That closes the loop. There is no other guarantee other than full compensatory damages from the first non-compliance." Iran argues that its demands and proposals are in line with the terms of the 2015 nuclear deal, and now many social media users are saying that the West needs to set aside their animosity towards Iran and lift all the sanctions imposed on the country. Otherwise, there's no reason for Iran to remain committed to the accord. On to our final batch of comments with a tweet by DIT. "Their whole intention and their sole negotiation strategy revolve around imposing a barbed girdle on Iran's economic growth and its influence in the Middle East. To that end, they resort to any and all possible and available means to achieve that goal and maintain it. I bet under no circumstances they will lift all the sanctions." Well, that's been it for this edition of Hashtag Trending. The rest of world news is up next.
Ebrahim Raisi became the president of the Islamic Republic of Iran in early August. During his time in office, Raisi has sought to strengthen ties with neighbors and other countries, particularly those on the eastern side of the globe. Domestically, he has focused on strengthening the country's vaccination campaign against the coronavirus pandemic. More in the following report.
August the 5th, 2021. Ebrahim Raisi becomes Iran's eighth president after a landslide victory in elections. He had little time to celebrate his win. Iran was facing a plethora of challenges, from both within and without. Raisi had to steer the country under severe U.S. sanctions and hit by a raging global pandemic. The first order of business was making sure of people's health. When Raisi took the helm, Iran was recording over 30,000 daily COVID cases. Several hundred people were also losing their lives to the virus each day. In less than 5 months, the numbers began to fall significantly. Iran got to have just over 2,000 new coronavirus cases every day. The number of fatalities reported daily has fallen below 60, and 3 out of 5 Iranians have been fully vaccinated. Also high on Raisi's foreign policy agenda has been expanding ties with neighboring countries. To that end, in late August, Iran attended a summit in the Iraqi capital. There, Iran's foreign minister met with its counterpart from Persian Gulf states in a bid to strengthen bilateral ties. Raisi's foreign policy brought Iran a major milestone in September, when the country became a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a multinational body which includes the likes of China, Russia, and India, and enjoys wide-scale global influence. President Raisi has also tried to shore up the country's economy by relieving the pressure of sanctions. His government has taken part in the Vienna negotiations in a bid to have U.S.-imposed sanctions on Iran removed. The next round of talks is set to kick off next week. The challenges Iran is facing are by no means over. But judging President Raisi's first 4 months in office, better days seem to be in the offing for the country.
Well, the number of COVID deaths and infections are on a downward trend in Iran. The country has reported 58 deaths, the lowest in 9 months. Some 2,100 new cases have been reported during the past day. 19 out of 31 provinces had zero or one case in the same period. Health officials have not registered any cases of the new COVID variant in Iran. The decline in the number of deaths and infections is largely due to the country's mass vaccination drive. Nearly 48 million Iranians have received 2 doses of the COVID vaccine, and some 1 million others the booster shots. And with that, it brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Data collected by Tianwen-1 mission and Zhurong Mars rover are offering insights into a previously unexplored region of Mars' northern hemisphere. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Smriti Malapati, writer. This article is published under the heading, China's Mars rover has amassed reams of novel geological data. Stay tuned for more. More than 30 scientists across mainland China, Hong Kong, and Macau are rushing to process data collected by China's Mars rover, Zhurong, and by the nation's Tianwen-1 spacecraft, which is in orbit around the planet. Several studies have trickled out, but researchers say that more are coming in the next weeks and months, offering insights on the climate, geology, and history of Mars' northern hemisphere. Since September, the National Astronomical Observatories of the Chinese Academy of Sciences, NAOC, which has been receiving the data from space, has released nearly 200 gigabytes of information that was collected from 8 instruments on the rover, an orbiter between February and June. These instruments include cameras, a radar system, climate sensors, and a laser spectrometer. Some surface features, such as possible sedimentary material and potential mud volcanoes, hint at the historic flow of water, so scientists are looking for any clues that there was once water or ice below the surface. This is of great scientific interest, as it might provide evidence of an ancient ocean, says Bo Wu, a planetary scientist at the Hong Kong Polytechnic University, who is analyzing some of the data. Tianwen-1 arrived at Mars in February. In May, it dropped a lander containing Zhurong onto a vast basin known as Utopia Plancha. The rover's initial mission was intended to be only about 3 months long, but it has exceeded expectations. Over a period of 4 months, the rover traveled more than 1,000 meters, visiting features of interest and even investigating part of the capsule that brought it to the surface, along with the remains of the descent parachute. In September, Zhurong was powered down into hibernation by the China National Space Administration, CNSA, because Mars had passed behind the Sun relative to Earth, meaning that communication was lost. However, in October, it was powered up again and has traversed another 200 meters in the direction of what may once have been the coastline of an ancient ocean. The month-long break offered mission scientists at research institutes across China a chance to start analyzing data. Some researchers had already received images of Mars from orbiters' cameras in March, and the CNSA had previously shared with the public images and videos taken by the rover during its descent and from the surface. But now researchers are studying the much larger volume of data released in September. This data set includes images from Zhurong's navigation camera, climatic data on temperature, pressure, and wind speed, information on the chemical composition of rocks, soil, sand dunes from a laser spectrometer, and clues from below the surface from its ground-penetrating radar. Apart from the handful of images and videos released by the CNSA, few scientific insights about the mission have been released or published until now. Researchers say this is because it has taken time to process and clean up the data. Doing this ensures that the data are reliable and removes noise produced by the instrument, says Lu Pan, a planetary scientist at the University of Copenhagen. The fact that this mission is China's first to the surface of another planet might also have slowed things down compared with NASA's recent Mars missions. She says, if this is the first time you do it, there is a learning process. David Flannery, an astrobiologist at Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia, who is in communication with scientists in China, says that the team's approach to managing data could also have contributed to the delay in releasing new insights. With NASA's Perseverance mission, which Flannery is involved in, each instrument on the rover is designed by a different team, which has exclusive access to data from that instrument for a few months before it becomes available to all. But under the CNSA model, the data generated for all the instruments on the Zhurong and Tianwen-1 are processed by the NAOC before making the information available to multiple teams of scientists linked to the mission. Two publications have already emerged. One study posted as a preprint in late September analyzed images and information friction that were gleaned from the movement of Zhurong's wheels. The results show that regions of Mars that the rover trundled over have properties similar to those of compact sandy soil on Earth. The study provides useful data about surface soil properties, says Xiao Long, a planetary geologist at the China University of Geosciences in Wuhan. This might be helpful for understanding how soil and dust on the surface formed, says Long, who is also conducting his own analysis. A second study published in August used high-resolution images from the orbiter to pinpoint the rover's precise coordinates on Mars, but researchers say that many more studies are expected soon, including some on the region's topography. So far, the data has been shared only with researchers directly involved with the mission, but Wu says the NAOC will at some point release them to the public and the international community. That could help to speed up the analysis. Scientists with more experience of Mars might be able to recognize features of interest and their significance more quickly, says Flannery. Mars is peculiar in some ways, and geologists are only as good as the rocks they have seen in the past, he adds. Zhurong will now continue to explore potentially for years, as some of NASA's Mars rover have. Tianwen-1 has also been busy. The spacecraft recently adjusted its orbit and switched from acting mainly as a communications relay between Zhurong and Earth to also conducting its own observations of Mars. Wen's five planetary scientists at Peking University Beijing, who is analyzing Zhurong's radar data, says that on November 11th, the CNSA deployed and began to test antenna for the orbiter's radar. Also earlier this month, the CNSA and the European Space Agency trialed whether the ESA Mars Express orbiter could be used to relay Zhurong's data to Earth, an exercise that Pan says is an amazing step towards increased international collaboration with China. As Zhurong resumes its journey, Bo says that he and his team are providing suggestions for future data collection that take in surface features of particular scientific interest.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The family of Agnes Wanjiru, a young Kenyan mother murdered by British troops almost a decade ago, is now filing charges to demand answers over her death. The brother-in-law of the murdered Kenyan woman speaks here about his pain and suffering.
Nine British soldiers joked about her death on social media several years later. The family now hope this fresh investigation will give them the answers they so desperately need.
I feel a lot of pain when I remember Agnes. We brought her up well, and just as she was settling down, her life was taken away, leaving us to fend for her young child. It's my hope that this child will get justice.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on the reopening of the file of a young Kenyan woman brutally murdered by British troops training in central Kenya in 2012. Kenyan members of parliament now say there have been attempts to cover up the murder. In the second part of our program, we shall look at the exaggerated reports of the return of some African artifacts looted by Western countries, especially France. The question many are asking is this: are Western countries willing to return every single artifact they stole from Africa?
Kenyan woman murdered by British troops. The body of 21-year-old Kenyan woman